We're going to call the House Finance Committee to order. The date is April 21st, Friday. Let's see, we're doing pretty well. We're only starting half hour late. Time is 9 o'clock, and on this morning's schedule, SB 304, SB 308. So if there's nothing, with us is Representative Moses, Representative Holman, Representative Foster, Vice Chair Stoltz, Representative Petula, Representative Hawker, Representative Wyrock, and myself, Co-Chairman Meyer. If there's nothing else coming for the committee right now, let's just jump right into the bills.
Can we do this one last?
I'm sorry?
Do it last, maybe?
No,
I'm just kidding.
When you said bill 54 last, sure, we can do that. Senator Dyson, welcome. We're a friendly group.
Yeah, thank you, and I suspect we'll be spending a bit of time together the next few weeks. Appreciate you hearing this bill. This might be the first bill I've ever sponsored that I don't think has ever gotten a negative vote yet, which is kind of amazing to me. What happened was the head of the sexual assault unit in Anchorage, a police sergeant I've worked with for years on sexual assault issues and child crimes against children, came and said that asked us to do this bill because some judges would not grant a protective order to a rape victim because sexual assault was not specifically mentioned in the code. And domestic violence and stalking are, and I think some of you had efforts in getting that into the code, and some judges will give the protective order and some won't. And so this bill just makes it very clear that they have that opportunity or the legal justification to do it. And if you look through the bill, you'll just see that most of the time it just goes and inserts the phrase sexual assault into the current code that talks about stalking. As is often the case with me, I got bit in my teeth and jumped out running on this one and got off a little bit on the wrong course. The first draft of it had inserted this language into the domestic violence section of it, which is really not appropriate. It was far cleaner to be in the stalking sections of the code. And while we were at it, we cleaned up a couple little other things in the protective orders bill. This makes it a little clearer about the notification that victims get and the record keeping so that victims will know the status of the perpetrator if and when the perpetrator might be back out on the streets or move back into the state. And some of you have probably heard some horror stories about how protective orders have been used in a manipulatory fashion to predispose custody or property dissolution agreements. And that almost always happens in domestic violence and so on. But we also include a little bit here. I think it's in Section 10 that says if you're going before a judge to get a protective order and you have any other actions going on, you need to let the judge know so the judge has a little better opportunity to make sure you're not using and abusing the process. Anyways, I appreciate your consideration, and I'll try and answer any questions.
Okay, questions for the sponsor?
No, I appreciate bringing this bill forward. It's always funny to see these kinds of provisions and you don't realize what's missing until later. And so thanks for spotting the issue.
Okay, and we do have, if there's additional questions, Lieutenant Jim Helgo, Department of Safety, and Doug Wilber, right there, is also here if there's any questions with for the court system.
Thanks.
Is there anyone, if there's no other questions, is there anyone online to testify? No? Okay, anyone here? Let's testify, okay. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, there are several folks here who have been following and supporting this effort since the get-go, and they are really kind of from the whole sexual violence community that works on trying to help victims and so on and so forth. And as I understood their comments earlier, they'd be glad to testify if you all need their support, but they are of the predisposition that I am, that probably you all will pass this.
Okay. Representative Stoltz?
Well, thank you, Chairman Meyer. I appreciate your work on this. Since I've known you, you've been a strong advocate for protecting women and children. This is just a continuing on that. I particularly appreciate the work on Section 10, and it's always like an opportunity to help the courts do a better job. Because they need a lot more guidance than they'd like to be allowed to have. And, I really appreciate that your endeavors on that allow them to do a better job.
Okay, very good. If there's no other questions, I'd like to go, first of all, let's close public testimony, and I'd like to take a look at the fiscal notes. There's six fiscal notes, if I understand correctly. And they're all zero. Is that right?
No.
They're on, oh yeah, here's one for 4,200. The public safety's got one for 4,000. Oh, yeah, there's another one, 10,000. Okay. All right. Yeah, none of these seem to be too, I think we can still afford $14,000, so should be okay. Is there any questions on the fiscal notes? Looks like a good bill, Senator Dyson. Representative Foster.
Yes, sir. I want to thank the sponsor for his advocacy on these types of issues. It's real commendable. I'll go ahead and move SB 54 out of committee with the attached fiscal notes and with individual recommendations.
Okay. Any objections? Seeing none, bill passes the committee. Thanks, Senator Dyson.
Thank you.
See you next.
Okay. This might be a good time to turn off your cell phones if you have on. If you want to just give us your phone number out there, we can call you. We're really hungry for donuts this morning.
Jerry's phone number. We need your cell phone number.
Okay, let's go on now to Senate Bill 304, Airport Parking Shuttles, Airport Charges. Presenting Senator John Cowdery. You don't look anything like Senator Cowdery.
No, Mr. Chairman, I don't. I'm a year or two younger, I believe.
Okay, Ryan McInster?
Yes.
Is that it? Okay. Ryan's going to introduce the bill to us and tell us what it's about. And the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm actually carrying this bill and basically bring it before you on behalf of the Senate Transportation Committee. And Senator Cowdery has actually been instrumental in dealing with this also, but it's actually Senator Huggins' bill, and he's been working on this pretty diligently. Under Alaska law, commercial vehicles, basically any type of shuttle service, valet service, fall into a couple of different categories if they're not part of a lease, arranged lease with the airport. I mean, you have tour buses, a standard bus, taxis. They're paying different rates depending on access to the airport. Under statute, these rates and fees are supposed to be reasonable and uniform to the same class or privilege and the services, and are to be established with due regard to property and improvements used and to the expense of operation by the state. One thing that's pretty important there is there's supposed to be uniform. I think the argument can be made that someone that is a hotel that basically comes to the airport, picks you up, and brings you back to the hotel, they are using the same service that someone that happens to have a parking lot off-site comes up, picks you up. They're using the same curb, the same amount of space, and the cost for upkeep of the service that they're using is the same, whether you're a hotel or you're airport parking or you're a shuttle operator. And this has not been a problem previously, but recently the Department of Transportation proposed regulation which would charge off-airport valet parking services 8% of gross sales. Currently, they're being charged a yearly rate based on the number of shuttles they have, and shuttles are obviously charged a different rate, about $2,500 a year. Under this 8% of gross revenue, their costs would jump to over $100,000 a year for this privilege of using the curbside service, while other valets, taxi cabs, and other units are being charged drastically lower rates. There's also a second part to that. This would also require a private entity that doesn't have a lease agreement at the airport to open their books because you're charging a percent of gross sales. And the sponsor of this bill thinks that's not the best way of going about it, to require a private entity to open their books so they can be charged a rate. This came about to some extent there's parking services, as most of you know, on the airport, and they were actually run through a contract by Diamond Parking at one time, about 4 years ago, I believe. They moved off-site. The airport now currently runs their own parking services on property. They're losing money, to be honest. And as soon as that started happening, this 8% of gross sales idea came to the forefront, that they're charging parking services while they're not charging other valet services. The contention of this bill is not what the rates may be, what's being charged by the airport for these different services. The contention is that this rate should be uniform for different entities using the same privilege, and a drastic change from $2,500 to over $100,000 seems odd and a little bit somewhat punitive for what's happening to the parking charges on property. So basically, this bill says that it reiterates the current statute saying it must be reasonable and uniform, and also it's saying you can't charge percent of gross sales for off-airport services. Basically, you can't look at someone else's books, it's a private entity, to justify whatever cost you're going to charge them. This bill does in no way limits what the airport charges. They could, if they wanted to charge $100,000, which is what's proposed under 8%, they could do that. This just says you can't charge percent of gross sales to achieve that rate.
Very good. Thank you, Ryan. Any questions?
On the fiscal notes.
On the fiscal notes? Okay. You want to, you want to do the fiscal notes, or is somebody else here to...
Mr. Chairman, actually, there's a fiscal note attached to this, and as the airport is revenue neutral, so there is actually no cost to the state. Any change in any loss of revenue, which doesn't exist yet because this is a proposed change, so they haven't incurred this loss of revenue yet. But if, say, they didn't, the airport parking wasn't charged $100,000, so that loss of revenue is assumed by all the concessionaires and the landing fees for the airport clients, which would be the airlines. So it's not a cost to the state. It's a pass-through cost to be passed on to the through landing fees and the concessionaires on airport property. We have not specifically in our office or in Senator Huggins' office have not heard from the airports any problem with this. They haven't realized, they haven't thought this is a big thing for them to come to the forefront about. $120,000 spread across that many people with their revenues is not a big issue for them.
Question, Richard Hawkins?
If I might follow up there, and you're exactly on point one of my 2 points on the fiscal note. The fiscal note that we have currently, the first line is it says that it would likely be a cost, shift a cost burden of between $150,000 and $200,000 from the off-site businesses to the signatory airlines. As I'm hearing this, I don't think that's an accurate statement in the fiscal note, because what this bill does is it would not allow the Department of Transportation or the airport folks to shift the burden from the airlines where it exists currently to the rental car facilities, rather than, as this fiscal note says, just the other way around. If we don't pass this bill, it's going to shift the burden to the airlines. Would you agree with that?
I'm talking to the chair. I think that's exactly right. If this proposed regulation had already been enacted, the fiscal note would be correct, but it hasn't. Basically, we haven't reached that point yet, so this would be shifting that cost back to them. And to some extent, shifting the cost of the loss of revenue from the on-airport parking right now, it seems like they're just trying to be shifted to off-airport parking facilities.
So I think, Mr. Chairman, I think that, again, that's a technical difference, but it's a pretty big technical difference in the fiscal note description. And the second point, I'm hoping it's no longer relevant, but I'd also like to cite in the description the bill would undermine changes the legislature enacted last year to ASO 215-090H and one to provide the financing mechanism, customer facility charge for the Anchorage Airport rental car facility currently under construction. So will this bill undermine changes that we enacted last year?
Representative Hawker, through the chair. That seems to be kind of a weird part with the fiscal note and some of the arguments have been made, because in committee last year, Senate Transportation specifically, the members were reassured that all costs for that unit were going to be assumed by the on-airport rental companies. And obviously it would probably be passed through costs to the consumer for that useless facilities. We were reassured in committee that they weren't going to go after other concessionaires or other people to cover that cost. And that comment right there seems in direct violation of what that promise was made last year. So I don't think this bill actually undermines it if the arguments made for the building last year are true. If you assume those promises made in committee last year were possibly questionable, then yes, this could actually undermine that. But we were reassured last year that this cost would not be absorbed by off-airport parking or other units. They'd only be absorbed by the people that are actually physically in that new airport parking structure or rental structure.
Okay. Thank you, Unai. So I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to ask someone who prepared the fiscal note on to justify their statement that this bill will undermine those changes.
Looks like it was Mr. Manley, and I don't see him here, so maybe we could call him and while we continue on his testimony. Senator Torgerson is? Okay, we have Senator Torgerson. Yeah, okay. Okay. We'll hold on to your question, Representative Hawker. Is any other questions for Ryan? Or? Okay. There's no other questions for Mr. McInstir. Let's go on to public testimony. Thank you, Ryan. Mike Neely?
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Neely, and I'm the Regional Vice President for Diamond Parking in Alaska. I'm testifying in favor of this bill. We've had a situation that's been hanging over our heads since we opened Diamond Airport parking facility near the Ted Stevens International Airport in Anchorage. If you're not familiar with our facility, in a complicated land trade and purchase with the municipality of Anchorage and private business, Diamond Parking has taken possession and owns the former Spinard Community Dump and has developed it into a facility with a capacity to park nearly 1,200 vehicles at a cost of about $12 million. What we sell is service. People park their cars at our facility. We pick them up at their car, transport them to the airport, pick them up again when they return. We are open 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and employ between 25 and 30 people with an annual payroll of about $500,000. And excuse me, I don't testify real often, so I'm a little anxious. To do business at the airport, we are currently required to have what's called a ramp pass for each of the shuttle buses that we operate. And to purchase those passes, currently we pay $500 per bus. The fee itself has actually changed around from year to year. It has been as high as $1,000. Right now it's $500. This is in line with the other charges that they charge courtesy type vehicles like shuttle buses for hotels, taxi cabs, tour buses, and that range from I think a low of about $35 a year for taxi cabs to about $1,000 for large tour buses. In addition to the ramp pass expense, the airport has gone after what they call off-airport parking for a percentage of our gross revenue. Based on the projections for 2006, this amount could be as high as $120,000 or a little bit more. and could make the difference between profit and loss. We don't think this is fair. All other businesses that pick up and drop off customers from the airport facilities are charged a flat fee.
Pick up and drop off.
We have been trying to come to an agreement with the airport since we opened. We, in a sense, have tried to negotiate. We operate two additional of these type facilities, one in Salt Lake City and one in Spokane. In Spokane, they pay just a flat fee per bus on an annual basis. Salt Lake City, they have a little bit different structure. They pay on a per trip basis. We thought both of these were fair. We proposed two solutions. One of them was to pay a per car fee for cars coming onto our lot. Our argument for a per car fee was the fact that the person in that car only uses the airport once coming, once going. The airport countered with a per car per day fee, which in effect is just a different way to structure the gross. The other thing, the other one that we proposed was a per bus trip. Salt Lake City operates under a system where each vehicle that picks up and drops off customers has a transponder mounted on their vehicle. Commercial vehicles are designated to go through a certain lane with a gate. The bus pulls up to the gate. Transponder says, I'm bus A1 or whatever. Gate goes up, the bus goes through, and it tabulates on an ongoing basis how many times bus 1A goes through. At the end of the month, the airport sends Diamond Airport Parking a charge for bus 1A going through the airport 2,000 times. This is the way that Salt Lake City does it. It's also the way that Seattle and Portland do it, and we thought that that was a fair system. Again, it corresponded directly to the usage that we had of the airport. We even proposed that we would fund the installation of the equipment, install it, and then deduct our fees off that initial expense till we reach zero, and then going forward, pay our fair share going on. Both of these proposals were flatly rejected by the airport, and they still stick with the 8%. So we've come to the legislature looking for some help. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Neely. Any questions? Mr. Neely. Okay. Seeing none, thank you very much. Did a good job.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Coffey, Dan Coffey, you online?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everybody.
This is the infamous Assemblyman Coffey.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this I am Assemblyman Coffey, but this has little to do with Assemblyman Coffey's full-time job. It has to do with my part-time legal practice.
All right. Go ahead, sir. Good to hear from you.
Thank you, sir. Actually, Mr. Neely did a very good job explaining the history of what we've gone through, and there's very little to add to that other than a couple of quick comments. I've heard during the course of the testimony on this bill that we Diamond Parking, were unwilling and unable to respond to their offers, and frankly, I think Mr. Neely dispelled that very well. Secondly, one of the problems that we've faced in our discussions is an attitude that advances itself at the airport that is best expressed this way. They tell us, but for the airport, there would be no off-airport parking. State statute says that people will be charged commensurate with the amount of airport they use. So in other words, for example, us and all the other shuttle buses use the curbs, drop off and pick. But for argument is the type of argument that leads to the conclusion that you're entitled, the airport is entitled, to percentage of gross receipts from anybody who receives any commercial benefit from the airport. Now, you could take that to its illogical extreme, which would mean they get a chunk off the hotels and the restaurants and so on and so forth. Of course, I think that the ridiculousness of their argument would become apparent if they got there. But I think what is most troubling to me is the fact that it evidences a total disregard for the existing statute, which talks about fair and equitable fees based upon the usage by the various people who make use of part and parcel of the airport. and we were reluctant to come to the legislature, but if the current law isn't followed, and they're seeking basically to do these off-airport taxes that can take $100,000 out of an off-airport business, it's very troublesome. The other part that's troublesome is the fact that the airport parking should have a very large competitive advantage over the off-airport parking. It's right next door to the terminal. But instead of seeking to operate in an efficient, customer-friendly way, the airport has taken what they viewed, I think, at the time as the easy way out and just said, 8% of your gross, Diamond Parking, you're doing better than we are, and therefore we'll take your profit. To me, it's indicative of a bureaucracy that ought not to be allowed to operate that way, and I hope that that the legislature and the committee sees it that way and will address this problem. We've done this before. Several years ago, we fought it when it was the off-airport tax for the car rental companies. And that brings me to my very last point, which is this. You ask about that comment in the fiscal note about how it might undermine the customer facility charge related with the car rental parking garage. And I think many of you know that I was at one time an owner of Dollar Rent-A-Car, and we sold out in December of 2005. We sold to Thrifty here about 6 months ago. So I was intimately involved in that issue of this customer facility charge, and here's what they are referring to. The fear was is that the people who do car rentals would move off airport, Hertz, Avis, and all of those, in the absence of a charge for the off-airport car rental companies, which, you know, in other words, sort of patently ridiculous. You think Hertz isn't going to be on airport. You think Avis, Dollar, Budget, those companies that are required by their franchise agreements or by their longstanding policies to be off airport. But to address that, the provision that would have included off airport car rentals in this current bill, in Senate Bill 304, have been taken out. So that issue has really gone away. Simply talking about these shuttle services now. So that's all I have to say. I thank you all for your time very much, and I'll answer any questions, sir.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Coffey. Representative Stoltz, question.
Thank you, Chairman Meyer. Mr. Coffey, maybe I get some legal advice. How far to the edge can they push us on those rental cars, and that might be considered off-premise? Because it seems like I'm walking half a mile right now.
Well,
that was facetious. Yeah. The question I have is about the administrative appeal. What is the process on that administrative appeal? And
it's an in-house process that allows an aggrieved party to challenge at an administrative proceeding prior to going into court any proposed regulation. And so the tack that was taken after we were unable to reach any sort of resolution as to a reasonable charge for using the curb was the airport said, well, we're going to go ahead with this rule, and we said, okay, we're going to take advantage of your administrative procedure, and we have a hearing. As far as it's gone today, is there's been a hearing officer appointed. There's been nothing else done. There's been no pleadings filed, no actions, you know, no hearings, no motions, no nothing. And at the same time, we said, look, an administrative proceeding costs a lot of money. Who knows where it'll end up? We don't believe that this is a good public policy, so let's take it to the legislature as well. And that's what we've done.
Go ahead, follow.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think I got the answer. It's not likely to be resolved before the end. Speed is kind of like DOT fast, right?
Not being totally familiar with DOT, I might say airport fast.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Representative Stoltz. Any other questions for Mr. Coffey? Okay.
Thank you, Art.
Very good. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yep.
Okay. Is there anyone else who wants to testify? I have some people online for questions that I know we do have some questions
for them.
No one else here? No one else online? Okay. Let's go ahead and close public hearing. All right, let's just, I don't believe there's any amendments at this time, so let's just go ahead and take up the fiscal notes. Actually, there's only one fiscal note. That's
really a fiscal note.
Yeah, fiscal note number one. It's dated 2-8. I'm sorry.
3-10?
Yeah, it's 3-10-06, yeah. My notes here says to adopt the 228 Department of Transportation, but I think this is the current one.
228 on the bottom, sir.
Okay, I'm looking at the top. Okay, the published date's 310, but yeah, right, 228. Okay, so I understand we have Mr. Torgerson. John Torgerson, are you online, sir?
There we go. I'm on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was put into the Senate Finance Committee at the end of that meeting, so I was disconnected, and I've been trying to get back through. So, a little administrative. So I missed some of the earlier testimony. I would just comment on the footnote. There was another one prepared that just hasn't been signed by Commissioner Barton, and it reflects the amendments that were made in House Transportation. Some of the impacts, of course, have been limited or removed by the amendment made in House Transportation. It's just the nature we can't, until it's signed, it can't be delivered to you folks. So, apologize for that. I don't really have a lot of testimony. I think you've heard what's there. The department still remains opposed to this legislation, although we appreciate the amendments that were made in the House Transportation, which basically limited the impacts on the new $65 million rental car garage. And the forward application fees and the application of fees and charges after January 1st, 2006 makes the bill a little bit more palatable. We are still a little confused about the intent of the in Section 2 of the effect of rental cars. We've had some internal discussion, and we're not exactly sure what that's intended to do as it affects off-airport car rental offices. It's out in one, but remains in two, or was added in Section 2. So I don't think it particularly hurts right now. We're just confused with why it's there. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions. I do have John Steiner on there from the Department of Law that can answer technical questions also.
Okay. Yeah, we do have John Steiner and Mark Plum also. I'll check with Mr.
Okay, good.
I'll check with Mr. Plum. He may want to testify. Mr. Torgerson, you may not have heard some of the questions that Representative Hawker had earlier. I think you have addressed them by saying basically you've got a new fiscal note coming.
Yes.
Is that something we'll have soon?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that Manny Sharofsky is there from the Commissioner's Office, and when we talked this morning, we're just waiting for Commissioner Barton to be in town so he can sign off on it.
Okay.
So I believe that will be later this afternoon, but I'm not sure of the Commissioner's schedule.
And it's still a zero fiscal note, is that correct?
It is still a zero fiscal note. It's just basically, see if I had a copy of it, one of the drafts, but I apparently have misplaced that in my file here somewhere. But it basically recognizes the amendment that was made in the House Transportation.
Okay. Well, not knowing what the new fiscal note says, the old fiscal note here talks about an 8% 8% parking service fee that's under appeal. Can you elaborate any more on that appeal?
Well, I think Mr. Coffey, I did catch his discussion. The hearing officer was appointed, and after the hearing officer is appointed, then the next process would be to file the complaints and briefs and whatever else, position papers, I suppose. I'm not sure exactly. I'm not even sure who the hearing officer is personally. I'm sure Mr. Steiner knows, but I have not received any word that the hearing officer has asked for any documentation to point. So I would only take a little offense with this. Talking about the speed of DOT, this is kind of outside of the realm of DOT as far as the hearing officer is concerned. There's more in the whoever appoints those, both sides were fishing for the right hearing officer. Anyway, we intend to continue on with the protest and the hearing officer process. So I hope that they get the get everything in order so we can start the process.
Okay. All right. Any questions for Mr. Torgerson? Okay, thank you, Ms. Ferguson.
Thank you.
Was that your cell phone going off? You know, when you were in the Senate Finance, it was $50. Here it's only a box of donuts, so next time you're in town, we'll
it wasn't my cell phone, Mr. Chairman. No, I learned the rule.
All right.
And I know it doubles when it affects the House Finance for the next senator, so...
Okay, thank you, Ms. Torkson.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
You have a question?
Good Torkson, yeah. John, can I ask you a question, this Representative Gatto?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
The question has to do with the greater on off-airport car rental, and it talks about 8% of gross sales or $250. Just curious, if there's a car rental agency, which there is in Wasilla, and people arrive at the airport, get a ride out to Wasilla and rent a car, is there a distance? I mean, if you're renting a car in Spinard Road, I think you're accessing the airport client debt base. But if you're renting a car in Wasilla, at what point are you not renting a car as a result of being part of the airport client base?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, my understanding of the regulations are that it's silent as to distance from the airport, but there have been no fees imposed on off-airport rental cars from that great of a distance.
Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Mr. Plum, did you want to testify, or are you just available for questions?
I'm just this is Mort Plum. I'm just available for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Very good. Thank you for joining us. Mr. Steiner, same.
Mr. Chairman, I could comment very briefly just on the one question you asked, or that Representative Gatto asked, concerning the distance.
Okay, go ahead. And
I would confirm the Deputy Commissioner's comment that there is no specific distance, but what the regulations do is they only impose the fee on a transaction whereby the car rental agency has provided or arranged for the transportation. So if it's part of the car rental agency's package to get the passenger to the car rental agency, then there is a possible fee. If the passenger simply transports themselves by a cab or some other kind of a shuttle to the car rental agency, then the fee would not apply at all.
Right. Yeah. Follow-up question there?
No.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Again, Mr. Steiner is with the Assistant Attorney General of Law with AG.
Yeah.
Okay. Attorney General. All right. See, if there's no one else, okay, we've done the public testimony. Is there any other questions for any of the folks that we have online here? I think what I'd like to do is hold on to this bill until we get the fiscal note, but I understand we're going to get it in the next hour or two, and so we can take it up at 1:30 this afternoon. Yeah. Attorney General Hopper?
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to if it would please you, and I know I probably wouldn't raise as much issue on the fiscal note, but again, if it would please the chair, I think I'd be very comfortable moving the bill out at this point, saving having to bring it back up. And I would only, pending receipt of a new fiscal note, and I would only ask your indulgence to allow, I would certainly like to review the fiscal note before we transmitted the bill.
I think it's best that we wait until we have the fiscal note so we can take a look at it. It's still zero, so that's what we're being told. So I don't think that's going to matter too much. But let's just wait until this afternoon. We should. It's my understanding we'll have it this afternoon. Somebody shake their head. Okay. All right. So let's hold this till we come back at 1:30. All righty. Then take up Senate Bill 308, Alaska Railroad. That'll be the last one we'll take up this morning. Let's see, Judy, are you presenting this bill? Is that her name? Okay. Hold on just a second here. All right. I've got Deborah. You're going to introduce the bill? No? Okay. I'm going to hand it off here. Okay. For the record, if you could give us your name, affiliation, and tell us why the railroad wants us to take this action. Go ahead, Mr. Gamble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Pat Gamble. I'm the President and CEO of Alaska Railroad Corporation, and with me is Mr. Bill O'Leary, who is the CFO for the Alaska Railroad. And I appreciate the committee allowing us to advocate for Senate Bill 308, which is a bill in accordance with state statutes and the Railroad Transfer Act, calling for legislative approval anytime that the railroad wants to sell bonds. And we are, in fact, asking for the approval to sell a bond issuance not to exceed $165 million for an acceleration of our track refurbishment effort that's been ongoing now for 10 years. I presented to you some data that I will speak to. The briefing is primarily the conveyance here that would, if you follow along, I'll quickly go through a little bit about what this issuance is for. I'll start with a little bit of background. In 1996, it was at that time that the Alaska Railroad, being a full-time, fully scheduled passenger railroad, realized it was entitled to certain federal subsidies that all other passenger-carrying railroads of a similar nature are entitled to. And it began to take in those federal dollars as well as earmarks that were primarily concerned at that point in time in the capital side of the railroad with rebuilding the main line. Those monies were funneled primarily into the main line of the railroad, which had been rebuilt in the 1950s after World War II, and then basically had not really had a lot done to it because the federal government was anticipating selling the railroad, and its capital program was very, very small in the intervening years before the sale in 1985 to the state of Alaska. When the state of Alaska got the railroad, the business activity level was rather small, the capital program was rather small, and very modest improvements were made to the main line until those federal dollars starting in 1996 began to come to us. Since that time, to fast forward, TILU, when it was passed, increased the attributable mileage that the Alaska Railroad is being recognized for, which in effect increased by a factor of five or six times the federal entitlement that we were eligible for with matching funds to gain on an annual basis. This influx of additional capital dollars gave us a tool in our toolkit that we had not used before. We'd always had the ability to sell bonds, but we'd never had done it. In this particular case, when TILU gave us the additional annual funding, and predictably we could see what that funding was going to be out into the future year after year as an entitlement, it offered us the opportunity to accelerate this track refurbishment program by going ahead and issuing bonds and then increasing the inventory and the work level and finishing off the work that had begun, that has been underway for the last 10 years, and in effect shortening the cycle time to the completion of that track refurbishment by as much as 10 years. Now, basically what that does for us is it means that you get a more reliable, safer railroad faster and reduce the risk of an older track considerably by getting that acceleration. You get it 10 years earlier. The bond debt service then would be repaid by the entitlements coming in each year, and the amount of those entitlements that would go to the debt service doesn't ever equal even 50% of our total federal capital input. So it looked very attractive to us, and as we ran the numbers and looked at the business case, we decided to come forward to the legislature and ask specifically for approval to sell these bonds. And it's basically, as we see it, kind of an up or down vote. I will just mention a couple of things. We've put about $220 million into the line so far. This project will be for not to exceed $165 million. It will allow for refinancing if we get a better rate and could pay off that and then issue the bonds again. That's allowed for. The length of the program would probably be stretched out as a function of three separate issuances because we don't need all that money at one time. as we, it's kind of like an owner-builder. As you need the money for construction, you take the money in. So we think three issuances would be about right. The effect of doing this, as I mentioned in safety, if you have the briefing in front of you, the first chart that actually shows a graph, it's entitled Derailments. It's about four pages in. You can see on the blue line, if you have that chart in front of you, that the trend line for the total number of derailments on the Alaska Railroad is certainly in the right direction. And the associated costs as a result of those derailments is certainly in the right direction. The thing about a derailment is, if you put one wheel in the dirt in the yard at 2 miles an hour, that's a derailment. If you put a whole train off the side of the tracks at 49 miles an hour, that's a derailment. It counts one each. But obviously the consequences are much more severe. The main line is where we're putting our effort, because that's where the consequences are severe, since that main line runs not only through some of the most pristine country we have between here and the National Park, but also runs right through the middle of some of our towns, too. And so we think, as a state entity, we have an obligation, if we have the wherewithal to do it, to accelerate this ability to provide a safer conveyance up and down through the middle of southeast central Alaska. The next chart shows the train accident rate. These are accidents attributable per million rail miles. And an attributable accident is an FRA metric that has changed a little bit over the years, but in a sense, roughly $6,000 to $7,000 worth of damage, it becomes a train accident. Well, you can see the trend line there. As a result of the work that we've been doing for the last 10 years, it has really made an impact. We want to continue that line right down as far as we can get it. We're even below the national average now, and that's where we want to keep it. What will this money actually buy? Project information is the next chart, is the next slide, and essentially we want to take the click-clack out of the rail, because every time you hear one of those, it represents an exchange of energy between wheels and rails, and that separation of the rails pounding against the wheels is where a lot of failures occur on railroads, and they're very, very hard to predict. The metal fatigue goes on, and suddenly it just simply fails, and then depending on the kind of train and the speed, you can have a catastrophic derailment. When we weld the rail, the purpose of this project would be to continue all the way to Fairbanks, the welded rail project that would essentially weld all the rail between Anchorage and Fairbanks. So the energy exchange at the wheel is gone. The mitigation is enormous in terms of the risk. Not only that, but the aesthetics going through town, the noise and so on, are quite noticeable. We'll also, in the curves is the other area where there's an energy exchange and where a high percentage derailments occur. We'll strengthen those curves and stabilize them by using concrete ties on every curve bigger than 6 degrees, which means a lot of curves will have concrete tie stabilization. On our wooden ties, there's nothing wrong with hardwood ties, good wooden ties, but they've got a surface life too. And what this program will allow us to do is get on a normal annual rotation that will give us a 35-year life cycle time, which is about 5 years under what the national average would be for wooden ties. That little margin, again, of safety of that 5 years is something we think we can and should afford. And then all the ballast, the rock, will be uprooted and relayed. And basically, you get a brand-new main line out of this project. At the same time we're doing that, our bridge program will go forward. We have a robust bridge program in which we've got 169 bridges on the Alaska Railroad, and a great majority of them will be refurbished as well. And a companion project, these are the physical aspects of the railroad. A companion project that works human error is our collision avoidance program, which we are funding with our dollars. Collision avoidance basically is using technology and GPS technology and data transmission to make sure that two items on the track at the same time will both know where they are with relation to one another, and through the use of computer assistance, will never have two items on the track run together. And that is a huge mitigation on the human error side, because right now we use dispatchers and radios to figure out where everybody is and who's going where, which works, but it is also subject to human error and miscommunication. So we think the project is really worthwhile, and it's within our ability to afford, and it does not place any risk on the state or the Alaska Railroad as far as the bonds. with the federal guarantee that we have with the federal funds. I think most of the briefing speaks for itself. I will not go into greater detail. The why now, it's basically because we can. We would have in the past if we could have, but now we can, and we think it's a great opportunity to move forward. It's also timely in terms of the potential for a gas pipeline. If the gas pipeline were to come along the railroad, we know in one way or another we'll be tasked, during the construction years particularly, and for the follow-on support, we need a robust solid rail line and one that does not have to divest itself of customers at the time it's taking on the increased capacity to build the pipeline. And we are getting ourselves in exactly that position now, and this project would secure that capability and capacity. The proposed funding, Mr. O'Leary is here to answer any of the detailed questions of the bonding, but in the main, as I said, not to exceed $165 million. Refinancing is authorized. It's in the bill toward the end, that one complicated paragraph that doesn't seem to make much sense. That's the one that basically says it's legalese and financialese, but it essentially says that refinancing is authorized if it makes sense. And then each step along the way, in other words, each bond issuance and the projects themselves on an annual basis would each be approved by our board as we went forward. So if we get approval from the legislature, our board still has their hand on the throttle to approve the expenditure of the funds per project and the amount of the bond issuance per issuance. There's a chart toward the back of the briefing that's called debt service as a percent of formula funds match. That just goes to show that even with a project of this size, we're still not quite at the worst year getting to 50% of our total capital formula funds. We still have those remaining dollars to put out to other projects, other work, and other labor that must be done up and down the Alaska Railroad. And then as we retire the debt, we even have more and more of those discretionary dollars to be able to put back to work off the main line. There are some more detailed charts in the briefing that talks about joints and failures and so on and so forth. Again, we can answer any questions you may have in that department. I would note one statistic in terms of the number of broken rails we had in 2005, 70% of them were at the joint portion of the rail. So you can see that welding rail eliminates a real threat factor there to keeping wheels on the tracks. Mr. Chairman, that's a short and sweet version of what this is all about. Thank you for the opportunity to address it before we stand ready to answer questions.
Very good. Appreciate the introduction. Sounds like you're going to be hiring a lot of welders here in the next couple of years. A couple questions. Representative Stoltz?
Thank you, Chairman Meyer. Mr. Gamble, is any of this bonding money, is it going to be used for realignment projects?
You mean realigning curves?
Yes, sir.
We're not going to be primarily the curve realignment projects. We are just in the process of completing the ones you're familiar with. We're just about done with those. These will be putting concrete ties in curves greater than 6 degrees, but not straightening those curves out.
Anything else?
Go ahead. Your mainline traffic density history between Anchorage and Matanuska, is the volume there, is that, my presumption is that's higher because of gravel. Is that a correct assumption?
That's correct. That northern route, Anchorage North, is from gross ton mile perspective between petroleum and coal and gravel. That's where the heavy wear and tear on the rail is. Exactly right.
Mostly through my district, both on the Palmer and the appreciate the maintenance work.
Anything else? Okay. Representative,
I just have one other quick question.
Sure.
This isn't technical, but you guys are fairly conservative on naming things. Is there on the post? Is Johnny Reeves appears to be about the only milepost you've ever named after anybody individually? Is that
No, actually...
there's probably other names here.
There are a couple other names. We've got a couple of railroaders who have worked on the railroad for a number of years where we're either proposing to name something or they actually have named a rather obscure siding someplace after an individual. And then Frank Chapados had a siding named after him up in Fairbanks as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks. I have you here, Bill. A couple things. It's my understanding, and I don't know if it's true or not, but it's my understanding that the low sulfur fuel is not going to be produced at Flint Hill currently. Does that affect your ability to pay back? Will that change the amount of fuel that's going to be passing down the railway, or do you know? Or
we absolutely know that the actions taken by Flint Hills have already reduced the total volume and the total revenue that we're getting from moving product out of the refinery. This particular project will not be affected by that loss in revenue. However, the railroad bottom line and the total capital projects completed by the railroad over and above this particular initiative right here are very definitely affected.
And one other question.
Sure,
Chairman, if I could.
This has to do with the structure of how you're rebuilding the line. It's my understanding that the reason that the railroad, when I was a boy, went back and forth and did all these kinds of things was because it was built in round rock rather than crushed rock. Do we use crushed granite or crushed rock today for our sub base rather than the round rock of the past, the pit run?
We do, and this project would replace all remaining round rock on that northern extension with granite crushed rock. The sharp edges interlock, and that's what you're looking for.
Absolutely.
We have a granite source now farther north that we will open up this summer, which will allow us to put granite through the whole project. We also buy granite up in the Fairbanks area also.
It's gold, isn't it? Don't you buy gold?
Well, there's probably a little bit in the granite.
Yeah,
but we've never assayed it, though.
Yeah. All right, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Stoltz. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's preliminary talks to folks that are looking at reopening that Hatcher Pass mine have said they alluded there may have been discussions between the quality of the rock that would come out of there might be suitable, so we don't have to go quite as far to get it as well. Is that have you any discussions from the underground mine?
Not that I'm aware of. That doesn't mean that they couldn't have been held at a low level in the operating side of the railroad and it just hasn't bubbled up to the management level yet. But we're always looking for good rock at the right price, and so we could very well be talking to somebody. At this point, though, I'm not aware of it.
Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
We got just a couple minutes. What are the status of negotiations at the Aklutna quarry, and can you just give a two-minute?
I'd be happy to. We signed, actually, after many years of arm wrestling, if I can put it that way, with Aklutna. We've gone back with a totally different proposal to settle the Aklutna quarry issue, and that's a very serious cultural issue with them, and the railroad is willing to settle that cultural issue with them and revert the property back to Aklutna, and that may be an initiative I would come back and ask for permission from the legislature to do in accordance with our statutes. But settling that issue has opened up a negotiation on some broader land issues that we have signed a memorandum of agreement. We have hired an intermediary engineering firm to go forward and work some land issues to our mutual benefit and land trades to our mutual benefit along the rail line, because Aklutna has some pretty interesting initiatives on their own to develop property and build. We want to contribute to that, but take in trade some property that would allow us to do some things around Birchwood that we're interested in doing, and we're making great progress on that right now.
Chairman, what part of Birchwood?
The airport.
The airport area.
Now, DOT's got some interest in expanding the airport, as you know,
okay,
and we've got them in there at the table as well, and this is the most progress we've made with Aklutna in years and years, and I've met with them several times, both the village and Inc., and we're in pretty good terms right now.
Yeah, that's a good negotiation. That's much better than going towards the rifle range.
Good idea. Okay, was there anyone else who wanted to testify on this particular bill? Anyone? Okay. So let's go ahead and close public testimony. I don't have any amendments. I think your bill is fine, Mr. Campbell.
There is some interest though in hopping on the train here, so to speak. Some folks are interested in making an amendment to this, which we've talked about. We're not going to let them mess up your bill. You have a good bill here. But if you could allow us one day to work with them, and we'll bring this back up on Monday. I'm not sure you need to be here, but then on Monday we'll readdress whether to move it as it is or go ahead and accept the amendment that's being proposed. So with that, let's hold this. Representative Foster?
Yeah, I just wanted to say I was digging around my father's attic. He passed away back in 79, but I found an identification card. He had worked for the railroad back in 1936. But anyway, I wanted to thank the general and staff for coming here today and coming all the way down here. I appreciate you.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And this afternoon, we do have a couple of bills scheduled to be heard. We have a couple that we just need to finish up on. Should be fairly light scheduled this afternoon. We will not be taking up PPT, so I think that was on the list there for a while. So with that, we're adjourned till 1:30.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Hey, Bill. Can I get another one of these?
Oh, yeah.
So why is he going to be here?
I don't have an extra.
I'm going to show you some reason, Chris. I thought we were just asking the other members, and they're going to keep them in.
This shows a running tally.
Go ahead.
This shows by year here what's going to be done exactly. You'll see the wide spots will show the work areas. This shows a cumulative tally year by year by year. You see the land start to get fatter and fatter as you get to work. So finally, I get up here, you basically get a point between the paper. We'll actually start to
get to the
Skagway.
So they did have a year.
They did have a year. They took action on it, but they moved it. And there are
my great uncle worked for the railroad back in the
different rules, but there are set of rules.